When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The Lifestyle Show.
Selina McKenzie.
Cold Talk Hot Cases with Selina McKenzie.
What fantastic music! I like that. This is Cold Talk Hot Cases, our brand new true crime program, and we would love you to join in with us. This is our first one. We'd love to know what your thoughts are on today's subject. You can call us on 952 78 4000, or you can WhatsApp 645 99 67 95, or you can email studio at tre.radio. Bit of a warning triangle, if you have any youngsters with you, we are talking about death and murder, so just in case you did want to turn the radio down.
Cold Talk Hot Cases with Selina McKenzie.
And Michelle and Leah back, Mac, and Marina Bruce. Welcome, ladies.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. So we're all true crime buffs. And this is from the Netflix documentary, Deadly American Murder, if any of our listeners wants to have a look at it. It's very interesting. So the victim is Jason Corbett. The suspects are his wife, Molly Martins Corbett, and his father-in-law, so her father, Tom Martins. And the question is, was this self-defense or a calculated killing? Was Molly a cold-hearted killer or a woman desperate to escape a controlling and abusive husband, aided by a father desperate to save his daughter? So for those that don't know, the story is that Jason Corbett sadly lost his first wife, Margaret, who he called Mags, and so he had two young children to bring up on his own. He advertised for an au pair, and that's where Molly Martin came in. She was from America. She came over to Ireland and took care of the children, and they had a romantic connection straight away, Jason and Molly. So they started a relationship, eventually moved to America together and set up home in North Carolina. And she effectively became the children's mother. So, ladies, to the outside world, they seemed like the perfect family, but were they?
Not by a long shot.
Not by a long shot, Leah. Explain why you say that.
I think there was issues within their marriage before everything started. I think you can see throughout the documentary, through the emails that were sent between the two of them, texts to Jason's friends that he had sent, that there were issues between the adoption of the children and Molly wanting to adopt them, his worries about divorce, and his primary reason was to care and the care for his children. He wanted to protect his children no matter what throughout all of this. And she wanted the children. She wanted to be their mother. I think that's shown throughout, whether it was malicious intent or not. She desperately wanted, even after she was arrested, her first thing that she said in the interview was, well, am I going to lose the kids?
She did, didn't she? Yeah. And he'd said that he wanted his sister to look after the children. So there was a big battle there, which we will come on to. I think she couldn't have her own children.
She suffered a miscarriage.
Oh, okay.
If I remember
which
rightly.
Which is why she went to Ireland to become an au pair. She wanted to start fresh.
Right, she wanted to look after children, or did she want to get into somebody's life who had children so that she could
take
them?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is whether she really did fall in love with him, or, I mean, maybe eventually she did, or whether it was really about the kids all along.
I tend to think it was about the kids all along, because I think if you look at the beginning part where they talk about her having lost the child, she was in a relationship, which had been quite a long-term relationship when she found out she was pregnant, was delighted about it. Ecstatic, obviously was devastated when she lost the child. But it said something about the fact that she realised then that the relationship she was in, that she thought was going to be a forever relationship, wasn't.
Mm.
So I don't know whether something was triggered in her by losing that child, where she felt this desperate need to just, it was about the children. For me, or it was not about the relationship with him.
Maybe it was in the beginning. Maybe she loved him in the beginning and then fell out of love with him for whatever reason, but had become close to the children and just couldn't let them go.
I think it's interesting because you look at the children's perspective from it and their interviews in it, and she had a stronger connection with the daughter than she did with the son.
But that's age-related, I think.
Well, no, but the daughter was so young that she would go on, she would go on to tell people that the daughter was her own child.
She did, didn't she? She was a bit of a fantasist.
But there was nothing about the son being her own child.
And he actually said in the documentary he felt a little bit left out.
He felt he had to fight for her attention the whole time.
So, moving on then, they had a strained marriage. Marina, what happened on the 2nd of August 2015?
Sorry, I'm not... Oh, I think Leah knows. Well done, Leah. She's going to cover for me.
It was the 911 call.
And I'm gonna play it for you, because to me, this is Molly Martin's father, and to me, he sounded very calm and very collected.
Too calm.
You have to really listen. I'll put the sound up. It's quite grainy because it was the original 911 call.
He's about that.
My daughter's husband, my son-in-law, got in a fight with my daughter. I intervened, and I think he's in bad shape.
He's in bad shape. Yes, you hit him over the head about 16 times. Now, the interesting thing with that as well, the only people that were in the house were, as we've discussed, Jason's children, Jack and Sarah, who were then 10 and 8, and her mother. So the father-in-law hit him with a bat. Is that right, Leah?
Yeah.
She hit him with a brick. Where the brick came from, I don't know. The mother-in-law, or...
Apparently slept through the whole thing.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. So she slept through the whole thing. She heard a noise and then turned over.
Heard the noise and then fell back asleep. Whilst the father got up, heard the ruckus, grabbed the baseball bat before knowing what this ruckus was. So he's already grabbed the thing that he's going to hit him over the head with and run in. But the blood on the inside of the door shows that there was already a fight going on between them previous to when the father entered.
There was blood splatter everywhere, wasn't there, on the crime scene. It's a difficult one. There were also apparently multiple, you know, you don't just hit somebody.
I think the thing that got me with it was the overkill.
Yes,
when you see the crime, literally, when you see the crime scene and you see what was done to this man, one of them, whichever one it was, lost the plot completely.
Well, there were abrasions on his forehead, his eyes, his shoulder blades, and his head. His head was so caved in, they couldn't figure out how many blows were made because it was so damaged.
And their reasoning was that, as the 911 call says, that the father, Molly's father, said that Jason was strangling his daughter, and so he had to intervene. But it wasn't just intervening with one blow, was it? That's the thing.
Well, I'm a firm believer that, you know, the science doesn't lie, and from what I've seen, the forensic evidence really contradicts that self-defense claim. And as Michelle mentioned earlier, it was really excessive force. Exceeding what you would need in if you were defending yourself. So I find the whole thing, I don't know. I'm not convinced by that story.
So after it had happened, the 911 call, etc., etc., they got taken into custody and questioned, which you can all see on the Netflix documentary. But as Leah said earlier, once all this had died down, while this was happening, Jason's sister and her husband, who were the legal guardians to the children, have flown straight to America from Ireland because he'd said, Jason Corbett has said, that if anything happens to me, I don't want her to have the children.
It was written in his will.
Yeah,
the guardianship would go to.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite hard that you don't actually do that.
Well, I'm just wondering whether the will had been written shortly post the death of the first wife. Because obviously, yeah, having lost their mother, he would have wanted the children, their birth mother, he would have wanted the children, maybe not foreseeing this relationship coming.
But there's an email to his lawyer previous to what, to when they'd moved to America, so when they were planning to move to America and they'd just started out their relationship and he was thinking about taking the next steps. He is talking to his lawyer about what would happen to the kids in terms of whether they got a divorce, and the lawyer says it is very likely that the kids could go to Molly in
because she brought them up.
Yeah.
But we saw repeated emails from or text messages from her to him saying, you know, I really want to adopt the kids, and he kept saying no, so there must be a reason. Yeah. He's because they did get married.
Yeah, one would think that there it was because he needed to protect his children from whatever.
Then he couldn't have been sure about his wife, could he?
Well, no, I don't know. See, part of me is the fact that the rest of the family were in Ireland as well anyway. So if there had been a divorce and they'd have been stayed in the States, it would have been very awkward for the family in Ireland.
But that was all they knew. They'd been brought up in the States,
yeah,
since they were little.
Absolutely.
She was effectively their mum. They were married. I don't know why he wouldn't want...
No, I mean, this is the slightly bizarre thing, but it was probably, and then when you, it's very difficult without giving too much away and going further down the line. I'm trying to be very careful how I say this, because if you listen to the children afterwards about that, they loved their life in America. They loved living in America.
They loved her.
They did. And when they were then going to be taken from her to go back to Ireland after he had died, they were terrified and horrified because that wasn't what they knew.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's take our first break and we'll come back and we'll carry on with that, Michelle. Do join in if you want to, and this is how.
To contact TRE, please call 952 78 4000. Email studio at tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
This is Cold Talk Hot Cases with Leah, Michelle and Marina. We're talking about the story of Jason Corbett and Molly Martins. And we have pretty much gone down the route that she's probably guilty at this stage, and the father is probably guilty as well. But there were certain things, like you mentioned, Michelle, the children were devastated when Jason's sister came and tried to take them to
absolutely.
Ireland.
I mean, you could see in the video evidence, you could hear it in their voices. They absolutely loved her, and they were very happy in the States, and particularly the boy, Jack, was very happy there and their life there. So, you know, she can't have been all bad in that sense, because kids have got a very good sixth sense and they know when, you know, they're being loved or not loved. And she obviously did love them, just in a slightly more possessive,
more obsessive way,
possessive, obsessed way than maybe was normal, in that sense.
Well, in the documentary, there were lots of videos of her playing with the children on the park, and you know, they were laughing and joking. It wasn't like she didn't seem to be cruel to them or abuse them or anything like that. But also, there were other things like the grandmother, which is Molly's mother, and Tom Martins, who's also accused, his wife. apparently gave her daughter Molly gave the children, her grandchildren, a code word, and she wrote a phone number, I think, on the bottom of a toy or something, in case they were ever needed. So that does say, was he abusing her?
I mean, could it be, you know, that the code word is in an emergency against him, or is it also against her daughter? Does she have a feeling that her daughter's also perhaps got some challenges? But I thought that was really interesting, because why would you do that? That's really out of the norm. And I think Leah mentioned during the break, it was just a couple of weeks before the murder, wasn't it?
Yes, that makes it easy. I didn't pick up on that.
There was a lot of changes in behaviour, apparently, according to all of the stuff, in that last month, in the month prior to the murder. There was a lot of changes in behaviour, atmosphere in the house, various different things. So whether there had been other stuff going on and it was all just starting to bubble to the surface.
Yeah.
I find there are so many anomalies in this case, so many weird little things that you can't pin, you know, and I think we'll never get to the bottom of. Things like the reason why the parents were there the night of the murder.
They'd just come for the weekend, apparently.
But they hadn't.
The father claimed in the first interview that he did with the police that they had nothing planned over the weekend and they just wanted to come up and drive 4 hours to go and see and stay with their daughter. They'd later found out that they actually did have plans. He had a dinner with his boss that he had cancelled that evening to come up and see his daughter.
Which then makes one wonder, was it premeditated?
Yeah, and the fact that Tom Martins was so calm and collected during the 911 call, and you actually saw him being questioned as well. Apparently he was a previous FBI federal agent, so he knew exactly what he was doing.
I think that for me, that he was calm during the 911 call, I mean, he must have gone through extensive training working for the FBI. So him being calm in that sort of situation doesn't really indicate that he's necessarily guilty or not. He was just what he was trained for, keeping cool.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe that was his nature,
Not. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what you guys think.
I think what's more interesting than the 911 call from him is the interviews that he did with the police, and you see him leading the interview As shown on the documentary, he's worked with interrogation techniques. Mm-hmm. So that's more interesting to me, is why is he then deciding to control? Because if, as a former FBI agent, you know, you're not guilty, you know that what he's done is right, why not be calm? Why not let them question you and answer the questions as they should? Why control it and give it from your perspective completely?
Yeah, that's also a good point. And they knew that, didn't they? The police knew exactly what he was trying to do.
He just gives me the creeps.
He's definitely a creepy guy. But you look at her, I've seen countless interviews with Molly Martins, and she just looks like a normal, you know, the way she speaks, a normal woman.
So do I.
They walk among us.
Exactly. That's the thing. You know, I could be a homicidally use-wielding maniac. Well, you might not know, darling. But seriously, that's the thing.
I know.
Is often these people do seem incredibly normal, incredibly credible, and they do, as you say, walk among us.
Do. She also, Molly Martins, also made some recording devices or got some recording devices on the advice of an attorney friend. And so she had got, as part of her defence, some recordings of him verbally abusing her. What do we think about that? Does that make her innocent?
Well, I'm not married myself, but I think you could ask, you know, a wide range of the population, and they'd all say that, you know, a husband and wife have both verbally abused each other.
So we all have rounds, don't we?
Again, I don't know whether that in itself is an indicator either way. But also, I think you mentioned that over a course of, was it 6 months, that there was only 2 recordings?
Yes, apparently so. That came out later.
Yeah, which is interesting, because she claims in the documentary that she wanted to use the devices to gain more control over the situation of the marriage and the adoption and everything, and then later goes on to say that him withholding the adoption was his control as well. Yeah. So this...
It's a lot of
fighting, fighting yeah. over the children.
Of defence for domestic abuse is really interesting because you've got, what, two recording devices and a couple photos to prove
and what, she
a
was
7-year
very,
marriage of yeah. domestic
she'd also,
abuse.
She'd also, on the advice of that lawyer friend to use those recording devices, she'd also consulted a lawyer about divorce and what her rights
she
to
did
the, children
about the children
were.
Yeah.
So, you know, one has to think her whole mindset is just... I can't lose those children. Whatever happens with him and me, I can't lose those children. The children were her raison d'etre.
And she sounded very, on those recording devices, it did sound like he was shouting at her. She sounded very meek, but then she knew that it was being recorded, so she could have been acting. He didn't.
Which is what the DA says in the documentary.
Is that what he says?
Yeah, he says, she knows she's planted the recording devices, so she has the opportunity to manipulate the situation in her favour.
Yeah.
With what's being recorded and
didn't
what she's
the boy,
saying.
Didn't Jack find one in the car with
yeah,
the father?
Yeah, in his son's car.
Yeah. No, well, in the father's car.
Yeah, and, but the other thing was, as well, the call that he made whilst he was in Ireland to Molly, saying, please don't share this with the public, I miss you, I love you, and then it was later shared and broadcasted on the news.
Interesting. Well, let's go on to the children, Jack and Sarah, because they were very young at the time, 10 and 8. And you can see in the documentary, they're both being interviewed. And they actually said that their father was verbally, quote unquote, abusing their stepmother. But we later found out that was that true or not? Interesting one.
Well, I think she... most likely manipulated these traumatized children, you know, and also from what they've said later on is that she coached their testimony.
Yeah, they did use words like my father verbally abused.
Well, I mean, this what, is what Leah said. Leah said the language words. That the children used wasn't the sort of language 10-year-olds would use in that.
It's also very, it imitates what the mother,
her words.
Molly said and her father said during the interview as well. It very much imitates almost word for word. They were fighting, he strangled her, dad went to grab a bat, and it's very consistent of this is what happened, this is what happened. It's like someone's written a page out.
I wonder whether actually it maybe wasn't her, it was maybe the grandfather. Maybe because as an FBI interrogator and knowing the sort of things, maybe he was the one that came up with the idea to coach the children.
Yeah, quite possibly. Maybe he even brainwashed his own daughter. Who knows? Well, Jason's sister did get custody. She won the legal guardianship battle and she took the children back to Ireland where they remained and they still remain. The court case just blows my mind. I mean, hopefully, Leah, you've done so much research. Look, hopefully you can tell me. But one minute they went to prison, they were guilty. The next minute they appealed and got off. Then they went back. I mean...
So they were arrested for second-degree murder first, which was their first trial. They went to prison for second-degree murder. They were going to be there for 25 to life. And then... 7 years later, I think it was. I've got it written down here somewhere.
They spent 4 years behind bars, off and on.
Well, there was 3 years before the appeal came up.
Yeah. Okay. So 3 years, and then the appeal came up. In the fourth year, the appeal went to trial, and they won the appeal. And then 7 to 8 years later is when the kids went back to America to see when the trial date was going to be set. There wasn't actually a second trial. It began the process, but then they both took a plea.
Right, OK. So because they'd already served time, that was because they were...
So the appeal happened. They won the appeal to go back to trial to reduce the sentence. I'm not completely sure, but between the DA and the defence, they both decided to talk plea deals because of the worry of the children. And defence-wise...
I think that with the other evidence that had come to light by then and the evidence that hadn't been admitted in the first trial, they were concerned about whether they'd get the, whether it would be overturned, whether it would be, whether they lose the case or not.
So does some evidence come to light?
Well, there was the inadmissible, in the first trial, they didn't admit the evidence of the children's first interviews. Yeah.
So the Firefly interviews in the house. Which
is why they managed to get the appeal, I personally believe.
Yes, it was partially with the children's interviews, and then they started to look into his first wife's death.
And yeah, that caused, was a big question, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that caused questions into his state of mind and what had happened previously in the marriage.
It was supposed to be an asthma attack, Maggie's?
Yeah, it was supposed to be an asthma attack, but they'd managed to find someone else, another doctor, a pathologist, that said it could be asthma, it could be someone strangling her.
Manual strangulation.
I think she had said to the children, hadn't she, that he had murdered the first wife.
No, that was the father-in-law.
The father-in-law.
So the first wife's father
had said so.
But then retracted, if you look.
So the father, Molly's father, had apparently met up with Margaret, the first wife's father, to have a conversation about the death of his first wife, and Tom had stated that the father-in-law had said that he had killed Margaret. He then later came out with a statement that said, I had not in any way said to Tom. The claims that he is making are false.
Yeah, and that was the children's biological mother.
Yes.
Sadly died.
Yeah, I mean, can you remember? That's the thing for me. I'm not going to touch it again, don't worry. Sorry, people. Something keeps falling off of my mic and I keep putting it back and it keeps falling
off. We'll take a break in a minute and I'll sort it.
The thing that gets me with regard to that is the, you know, those children was, you know, they'd already lost one parent.
It's very sad.
The trauma of losing a mother.
Yeah.
And then to go through the trauma of losing a father, and then the years and the years and the years.
Well, it's also the pain that the defence had put on the daughter, claiming that she was the reason that both parents were killed.
They
were building up a defence saying, well, the first time it was because the daughter had woken up crying.
Yes.
And the second time was because she had a nightmare.
She had a nightmare, and that's why they were all up.
And to do that to such a young child, to put that weight on them as well, is horrific.
Well, let's take our next break, and then we'll come on to the children, because they actually changed their testimonies. Don't forget, you can join in. Let us know whether you think they are innocent or guilty.
To contact TRE, please call 952 78 4000. Email studio@tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
This is our new true crime programme, Cold Talk Hot Cases. We're talking about the case of Molly and Tom Martins and Jason Corbett with Marina, Leah and Michelle. And we've had a couple of emails in. Thank you. The first one's from Mike in Sabineers. He said, a question for you. Why was the murder not caught on the recording devices? Has she turned them off ahead of the killing? I've never even thought about that.
Excellent. Mike, why weren't you watching with us?
Yes, because that never came up on the documentary.
No.
Did it at all, if the recording device is wrong.
But then, you see, I said to Leah, I couldn't understand why there wasn't greater psychiatric evaluation of her as well with regard to various things. Mm. So there were a lot of things that didn't ring 100% for me.
Yeah,
but
and of the children.
Leah says it's down to...
Well, the issue with psychological and mental illness and claiming it is when it goes to trial, most of the time it's the defence that brings that to cause because it helps the defence's case.
So
the DA, obviously, with the... I can't think of the word now. With all the
evidence.
That's the word I was looking for. Be helpful. With all the evidence that was given to them, they obviously... saw that they had enough evidence to convict that first conviction, which they did. It was the appeal later which obviously changed the conviction, which then obviously they could have brought in the fact that she had been known to lie before previously about other things.
Hadn't she? We hadn't touched on
that. So she'd...
She says something to her at the wedding.
She told the maid of honour that the kids were her
godchildren.
She was the godparents to the children. She'd fabricated that she'd given birth to the daughter. She'd told friends, college friends, that she'd had a sister that had died of cancer that she'd never had. So she's been known to lie in her everyday life.
She also said that she was childhood friends with his first wife, which,
Why say that? Quite a bizarre person.
It's brilliant.
We've had another one in from someone who said, please, can you not say my name? So we'll call you anonymous. He says, I'm just reading out what it says. Good God, 4! Is this even a question still? 4! Premeditated murder. Why else would she have that brick in her bedroom?
There's an explanation. Whether we believe it or not, that's the question. So she told, and the son had told the interviewer as well, the police, that they were painting cinder blocks, bricks, to plant flowers. My question is, there's a photo of these bricks outside in the documentary that you see with the flowers. There are multiple. Why have you only got one in your room? She said we're painting bricks as a family with the children. Why have you not got one for the daughter, one for the son, one for the mother, one for the... Why have you just got one on your nightstand?
But you could always say one of the children, you know, that then you can say, well, one of the children just bought the brick in that day and said, oh, we'd forgotten to paint this one. I mean, there are a million and one convoluted excuses you could come up with for that.
The problem is, I suppose, in a court of law, it doesn't matter what we say, what we think, or what it seems obvious, it has to be proper evidence.
It has to stand up and to all the rigorous tests, otherwise there's no point in it at all. No.
So who wants to talk about the fact that once they were older, they'd been living in Ireland for a few years, Jack and Sarah, the children, they retracted their stories.
Retracted his story first.
Who, Jack?
Oh, the son. Yes. Oh,
the son had retracted his story first.
And how? Do you know how old he was when he did?
I'm not 100% sure how old they were when they'd retracted it. It wasn't long after, though, that they'd moved back to Ireland.
I think it was within a couple of years.
Yeah.
Oh, and I thought it was longer than that.
The interesting thing with the retraction and when they got re-interviewed with it was that they weren't asked to come back to America for the interview. To be re-interviewed. No one came over from America to interview them. It was done over a video call.
Right.
For something so serious as the retraction of a statement, wouldn't you think to take it a little bit more seriously?
Just a little bit, definitely. Val in Murcia said, I've just watched the documentary as well. The only testimony of Jason being violent came from Molly's side, so it's shady at best. Couple that with the fact that the kids admitted later that she forced them to tell the story they told in their interviews after the murder. So Sarah eventually said so as well. She said that they were forced to say what they said when the murder happened. How sad using children like that.
I know, but some people are very manipulative.
And they even gave their impact statements as well, didn't they, the two children
later
on? Those
broke me at the end of that programme, I have to say, that I found those very, very, very moving.
Yeah, very sad indeed. So at that point, they were now 17 and 19. I mean, they must be in their 20s now, I think early 20s, something like that. Molly is free, they're both free, but she's not allowed to have any contact with the children, and she still says that she would like to get to know them.
Oh, that was the weirdest thing throughout the first trial when they were being interviewed, was her using social media as a way to contact the children.
That's right. Ooh. Yes, she was, wasn't she? Yeah.
Yes.
Posting her phone number and pictures of the children and I can't speak to them and I haven't been able to see them and this is so sad. Please contact me. It's very... strange.
I'm certainly not excusing, you know, what happened, but I think just from all, you know, all of this, all these stories we've heard about her, I think she definitely has some kind of personality disorder.
Yeah.
And so you can't judge her actions of what a, you know, sort of normal person would do. Because
this was what my view was. I felt that there was definitely some sort of personality disorder there. And this was why I was so surprised nobody had gone down that road.
Mm. Yeah, she definitely needs help. And it makes you wonder if she's going to do the same sort of thing again.
Oh, gosh.
The father. Well, you don't know, do you? I mean, did prison
do anything? Well, you know, it's the thing that I was left with was which one was covering for the other on that. Was the father the one that was covering complete, or was it equal? You know, that was what I was left with, this very strange feeling of not knowing really who'd done it.
Well, really, I think she did it.
Oh.
Yeah, but, but it's got to be the father as well, hasn't
I think
it?
He was...
I think he was protecting her.
I think he was I think he was protecting her and very much an accomplice, I think.
When you know
what your father does and who he was as a person, why not?
Except my thing is, she's a very slight built woman.
Yeah,
he was a big guy.
You wouldn't be surprised.
I know that it was a cinder block involved, but she literally beat the CRAP out of
him. But did she or did he?
Well, that's what I don't know. Do you think he was asleep?
I think he was asleep and it was just easy pickings. Yeah.
You see from the blood spatter and what the evidence they took from, there was blood in more than one room. So the altercation took place in more than one room. The living room, the bathroom, the bedroom all had blood. There was blood on the inside and outside of the bedroom door. So there was obviously an altercation before someone else entered in. There was blood on the bottom dragging down of the walls and an indentation in the bottom of the wall almost touching the ground, proving that he was on the ground when they continued to hit him.
But forensics would know if he was asleep. He sleep where? In bed?
What I had seen was that the bloodstain pattern analysis showed that the first blow was while he was lying in bed. Half asleep or drowsy or whatever, it might have started
there. You had that evidence that apparently the father was, you know, said, oh, he hit him with the bat. Well, there was also the thing, well, if he was looking at him, how could he hit him on the back of the head with the bat? Because, you know, they were saying that he had
the wife in a chokehold.
Well,
the father was in front
of them. Well, if you're looking at that, you can't actually hit somebody on the back of the head with a baseball bat.
Also, if she was incapacitated by him, how she managed to grab the...
I think she didn't have any bruising either, did she, on her neck?
She had very slight...
Yes,
so she had very slight bruising on her neck and what could be considered a nail indentation just below her ear. Mm-hmm. That is the only...
Proper strangulation.
But there's no scratch marks. There's no grabbing
the way
bruise marks.
Neither of them had any defensive injuries.
I think that says it all.
Yeah. I think it does, sadly. I've been trying to go down the innocent route, but I don't think... seriously, Molly, I think you're... Anyway, we'll see what our listeners think. We'd like to know whether you think that Molly Martins and Tom Martins, her father, are guilty or innocent, and we'll do a tot-up after this.
The Lifestyle Show.
Selina McKenzie.
Okie dokie, we're in the last 5 minutes or so of... I was going to say the Me Nobody Sees, because you're here, Michelle. You've thrown
Sorry.
Me. Cold Talk Hot Cases, our new true crime show. I think we pretty much know the answer, but we've got one more email from Ray, who says, guilty, guilty, guilty. And he also says, my conclusion is Molly is a narcissist fantasist who latched onto a grieving family so she could pretend the baby girl was her own daughter. After Jason married her and they moved from Ireland to the US... he was isolated from his family, which he was,
yes,
and increasingly unhappy, but he provided an affluent lifestyle and the all-important accessories for her image, including the beautiful little children. When she figured out he was going to leave her, he was, wasn't he? He was going to leave her.
He'd said in the last month as well, he'd messaged a friend to say,
about... He called her crazy in one of the texts. Mm-hmm. That says a lot,
clearly.
When
she figured out he was going to leave her and she'd no parental rights after the divorce, she conspired with her father to kill him. So, we have had... This would have been the innocent one. But there aren't any innocents. There aren't any innocents. At the moment, we have 5 for guilty.
Uh-oh.
You've still got a few minutes if you want to let us know if you think Molly and Tom are innocent or guilty.
Leah's got some interesting statistics, haven't you, about where they moved to as well?
Tell us. She claims in the interview that one of the reasons they moved to America, one of the main reasons, was for the welfare of the children and for a better lifestyle regarding raising the children. And I heard that and I thought, really? And I thought, OK, I understand the UK is sometimes not the safest place to bring up children. Don't let them walk out at night alone and all that stuff. But you've not got 8 shootings in the 8 years
that they lived there. I was going to say, you send them to school and they get shot.
That's the amount.
2009 to 2015, there were 8 school shootings in North Carolina, which is the state that they've moved to. One of them being in the surrounding area in which they lived.
And I wonder if Jason Corbett knew that. Because otherwise, why would he have agreed to move unless he was genuinely in love with her?
I think she'd hoodwinked him.
I think there was genuine love with Jason there. I think he felt that he wanted to move on and create a life and have his children have a mother.
Have a mother, yes. I think definitely.
I think that's very much... I think he was also very wary. You see, before their marriage, how wary he was about marrying her and bringing her in as the mother of the children. And I also think it's a very strange way to start a relationship and a marriage. You've come in to look after someone's children, so there's already that instant connection between the children and her.
It's more common than you think.
It's more common, yes, but it's the norm of it, and the norm of, especially when you've had a wife pass already and you're bringing someone new into the family, the norm would be them two just going out on dates and getting to know each other more and then slowly introducing the children in. It went the complete opposite. It was, I'm completely in the world of the children, and then it was them two getting to know their relationship and how that
but
could evolve.
But I think
evolve.
He was probably easy pickings for her.
Maybe.
You know,
maybe
he was
vulnerable.
Grieving.
Very vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly, vulnerable. And it was almost like the perfect storm, I think, that situation.
I just don't... I mean, from everything we've discussed, I know we said about it can't be circumstantial evidence, it has to be evidence, and obviously it's all gone through several courts of law. But from everything we've discussed and from everything that our listeners have agreed on, they're as guilty as hell. So why are they not both behind bars? That's what gets me.
It's to do with the legal system,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is completely to do with the legal system and the fact that they appealed for a second trial. And the fact that during that appeal for the second trial and when that second trial was about to start, they didn't actually go forward with the trial and they took the plea, which is why they got their sentence reduced.
Right.
Was because both the DA and the defence lawyer agreed a plea for both of them that they were both happy with. If it was left as both that the first conviction of second degree murder, they would still be in prison to this day. Mm-hmm. The fact that Molly got in touch with her lawyers and wanted an appeal and wanted to go to trial again is why
really
the conviction changed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is what saved them.
Well, Christine is Santa Ponsa's juice and I'm on the guilty side, so we've got six now.
Uh-oh.
So where are they now? As far as I know, Tom and Molly Martins are living a normal life in America, and their children, Jack and Sarah, are living with presumably his sister still, Jason's sister, yeah, in Ireland. It's a sad case, actually. It's one of those where there's no winners.
No,
just
absolutely not. And those poor children to have been through all of that for the largest part of their adult lives, yeah, and not have any, you know, the normality that most kids their age would have.
For it to be dragged out and for her at the beginning to be so concerned about the children's well-being, for her then to bring it all up again once it had been settled so many years later is...
But I think I really agree with one of the gentlemen who emailed in, and he said she was a narcissist and a fantasist.
Yes.
And I think that sums it up really well.
Yeah, definitely.
She, you know, that sort of fantasy world, because you can't, you know, you can't be out there living a normal life and do the things that she did.
No, absolutely not.
I was trying to find it. I can't find, unless you know, Leah, the name of his sister, Jason's sister, but I think she would have been a mother figure. I think she would have been a really good mother figure.
Yes.
We can't just throw names
out there.
And
it's really interesting. The one of the things that I picked up on in the programme, they have another son who obviously they brought all the children up together.
That's right, yeah.
And he's seen very evidently in all the videos going to the court with them and everything. His name's not...
They don't give his name.
Might be his choice. He might have not wanted
privacy.
It might have been a privacy.
It must have been quite... If you think about it from his point of view as well, what an interesting situation to find yourself thrown into. Mm. All of a sudden you're an only child, then you've got two more siblings and this whole mad case going on around your life.
And also there was not much said about the mother apart from the fact she didn't wake up. She was never
mentioned either. The father was very briefly interviewed for the documentary. There are very few actual snippets of his interview.
Thank you, Tracy. Tracy's just watched WhatsApped in and said she's my namesake. The sister's called Tracy. Yeah. Tracy Corbett Lynch. That is it, our first ever true crime programme on TRE. Thank you so much, Marina Bruce, Michelle and Leah Mack.
Thank you.
You see, I lump you into one. You're not two people. You're just...
We're just one
person.
Just one person.
We know.
Do listen to us again next month if you enjoyed this programme, and we will do another one on another subject.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.